Hello, you're listening to Social Science Talks Science Fiction, a podcast in which social scientists, philosophers, researchers and theorists discuss the themes and works of science fiction. This podcast is recorded in the International Politics Building at Aberystwyth University and is available free under a Creative Commons license. We hope you enjoy the program. Talking about a seminal science fiction creation, Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry said, "It is important to the typical Star Trek fan that there is a tomorrow. They pretty much share the Star Trek philosophies about life. The fact that it is wrong to interfere in the evolvement of other peoples, that to be different is not necessarily to be wrong or ugly." Star Trek is now 50 years old, and it's hard to find a science fiction fan who has not had some sort of involvement with the franchise. At the request of a listener, we decided to sit down and discuss the entire Star Trek franchise. Every series, every film, probably not the terrible novels. I'm Matthew Campbell. I'm joined by...
Alex Hoseason.
Yvonne Rinkard.
Jeff Shahan.
Okay, so I guess the good place to start is, how did we all get into Star Trek?
Well, for me, it was after News Round, which was the kids' news program on evening TV, and probably after Blue Peter. So it was on about 6 o'clock, so it was kind of just before dinner time or something. So I was sitting down with my fish fingers, noodles and peas or whatever it was.
This would have been Next Generation in its original run, right?
I'm not even sure if it was the original run, to be honest. I genuinely don't know. I mean, I know that either I didn't watch it consistently enough or some of the episodes were out of order. So I don't remember any Star Trek, to be honest, as a kind of coherent series, just as a kind of episodic thing. But I mean, it was kind of cool. It was like, I probably also saw it before I saw Star Wars, which meant that was kind of more of a way in for me. So for me, Star Wars was always a fantasy story, whereas Star Trek was a science fiction story. I mean, not necessarily in those terms, but it was slightly less kind of adventurous and there was a bit more talking. I really liked it. I mean, yeah.
I think the same is true, is that certainly growing up, I don't remember a time when Star Trek wasn't... So my grandfather and my mother were both quite big fans. So Star Trek as a pop culture thing was always kind of present. But the first thing I probably remember watching is out of context, out of order episodes of Next Generation, probably on repeat.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, doesn't really seem to matter because of the episodic format. And I wonder if that's why Star Trek's really approachable. I mean, I don't know if American TV had a better approach to running the episodes in order.
I don't really remember. Like, I don't remember the first episode I watched, nor the 10th or 100th, probably, because it all sort of blended together. I watched the original series and the Next Generation sort of overlapping all at once. It was just whatever rerun was on when. And it just sort of blended together into this sort of universe of sci-fi that was a nice break from my mom's obsession with Godzilla and Mothra. It was just a fun thing you tuned into on a weekday afternoon.
I like the idea that Riker is somehow a break from Mothra.
Totally.
So I think I saw the dubbed version on German TV. So I think the first time I really remember was like when they were showing it, I think, on Saturdays. So it was like once a week. And again, I didn't like watch it regularly. But I think the first kind of series that I watched as a thing was Voyager. And then the other stuff was kind of around every so often. But I think that the first one that I watched semi-consistently was that one. I guess.
I'm going to say that watching The Next Generation as a kid, at least, and a young kid at that, I think The Next Generation is probably difficult to follow, or one of the more difficult ways in for someone who's not watching it consistently, or probably doesn't really have any concept of a consistent TV series over time, because it's also the one that starts mucking about with timelines and all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's lots of kind of alternate bits, and then there's holodeck episodes, and then there's the films, which...
I hate holodeck episodes.
But then, you know, then there's the films which screw with, you know, you have Generations and all the rest of it. You know, so you have all these characters that are cropping up that you've never seen before, are obviously, in retrospect, significant because you've called it Generations and it's got old people in it, right? But, you know, like, you know, all these things, it tried to be... Actually, I would say it probably tried to be cleverer than it was. And as a result, at least for my young mind, was probably a little bit confusing.
I guess, I mean, certainly one of my salient things I remember about Next Generation, and TV programs do this a lot, but this was the first time I was aware of it, is that I've realised that the teenage boy character is put in there because I'm the target audience. And I remember that was the first time I realised that a character was there for that reason. And it really, really annoyed me. I realised that media was manipulating me, and I had this irrational hatred of Wesley Crusher for the longest time.
Are you so sure you are the target audience, though? Because Will Wheaton had a huge fangirl following.
That is
and
true.
And a lot of the US media was actually directed towards teen and preteen girls.
You could have been Will Wheaton, Matt.
Not want to be Will Wheaton.
Yeah, but I guess Voyager is the same way, right? Then I'm pretty sure the reason why I liked it was because it had a female captain, yeah. Right? Now, I don't know whether I was the target audience for that, but that's specifically why I liked it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of hard for me to relate to. I was just thinking that, like, in terms of the usual TV tropes, right? So you've got the sex appeal character and all the rest of it, right? And the character that you aspire to be, and all you know, whether Will Wheaton's a heartthrob or not. But I mean, I don't think I relate to it in that way because I didn't watch it when I was old enough, to be honest. But I mean, it's quite obvious looking back on it that you have characters like Seven of Nine,
yeah,
and things that are kind of at least straddling that line. I mean, I've not got enough in-depth knowledge to know whether she actually goes beyond that as a strong female character.
Well,
but
it's certainly the. So people will latch on to Janeway. I know someone who, as a teenage girl, Tasha Var is not a brilliantly written character, but a lot of people latched onto her because she was a female character on The Next Generation. The famous one is, of course, Oprah Winfrey seeing Uhura on the original series and just latching on to the idea of a female character, even though she's not the lead character.
You were thinking he confused Oprah Winfrey with Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah, and then I remember that she did
there's
actually
that
mention
story
that.
About, yeah.
There's that famous story, and there's also the famous story with the actress that plays Uhura in the new movies, sort of meeting and sitting down
Zoe
with
Saldana,
the actress that
yeah.
played her earlier.
But I don't think it's necessarily for the sake of... Well, maybe it is strong characterization, but there's not much character development, right?
Well, certainly... So Gene Roddenberry, in a very positive way, was absolutely about representation.
Yeah, yeah.
He wanted a Japanese character. He wanted a character from a Warsaw Pact country. He wanted a woman of colour on that bridge.
And of course, having a Japanese character as an American TV series was probably...
Having an Asian deck officer at a time when America is at war in Vietnam, has just got out of the Korean War, people have memories. I mean, George Takei had been in an internment camp.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the other important thing to remember is the story of Michelle Barrett-Roddenberry as well, who in the pilot was originally cast to be second in command, but the network objected to her role in that series or having a woman in that strong of a role,
right.
And was actually then replaced by Spock, who, of course, goes on to be second in command and does a wonderful job with the role.
And
but
becomes the iconic Star Trek character.
And in the end, we have Michelle Barrett-Roddenberry as the computer voice.
Mm-hmm.
Is something about computers always having female voices?
Well, that's interesting. A writer who, and if this is the wrong name, I will correct it on Twitter, I think it was Laurie Penny, wrote a piece recently about whether... And science fiction portrays an artificial intelligence as male or female. Because usually malevolent, out-of-control AIs are actually characterized as female.
Showdown.
GLaDOS.
Yeah.
GLaDOS, the AI in the iRobot film. There are exceptions. You can look at, say, I Am or HAL. But generally, whether or not you make a computer male or female is not a neutral statement. Because there's something about the omnipotence... But also about the servitude.
Yeah, I mean, there's also these are ones from games, right? GLaDOS and Showdown, but
Cortana is the other one.
Yeah, Cortana. I mean, an Angel from Borderlands. But I mean, in a lot of those things, you know, they do have a slightly maternal role, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, actually, the thing that's horrifying about System Shock is the space station, so the place that you're living and breathing and eating, is rejecting you, right? In quite a forceful way. So there is this kind of semi-maternal thing. I mean, I don't remember the ship in any of the Star Trek things having a particular personality. I mean, unless there was an episode about. I mean, it's not like Hitchhiker's Guide levels of personality.
Although it is interesting, there's an episode of Voyager where the central computer is stolen. And they have to go off to a planet to actually try to steal it back. And on the one hand, they're somewhat lost without their computer, for obvious reasons. But it seems like there's also an almost emotional component to, like, this major piece not only has been taken, but is just no longer there.
Mm. It's a basic rule of any naval drama, and space is a naval drama, that you personify your ship, and you almost always do it as female.
Yeah, I mean...
Unless you're the culture.
Yeah, I mean, Homeworld's the most obvious thing, right? Because it is literally called Mothership, and relates to its inhabitants, I guess, is the right... that way.
Homeworld's Mothership gets you to care about it by pointing out that a woman sacrificed her body to make it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that she is Mothership Pride of Agara and not Karen Saget is kind of an interesting choice, right? She's awake and alive in there, and yet everyone refers to her as the object, not the person.
Hmm. I mean, we're drifting a bit, but...
Yeah. Well, to bring it back, mate, it might be useful to think about the captains, then, in relation to the ship.
Right, which one's best, Yvonne?
This is not where I was going.
But because the obvious answer is Cisco.
It clearly is not. But to link this back to what Jas was saying, that and what came to mind about this is that I think maybe the computer or the ship works differently in Voyager specifically, because you already have a mother figure on top. You don't like need a computer and a ship to do that as well.
Mm, yeah.
Whereas I don't know how that would have worked out if, I don't know, the Enterprise had its computer stolen or something.
In a way, it's a sort of lifeline, I think, for Voyager. It's their way of getting home, also their connection to their cultures, the sort of materials that they can access, even, you know, personal documents or that sort of thing. It's not just... say, the mother figure, but some source of identity.
To what extent does the show portray Janeway as a mother to her crew?
I think there'll be people thinking about that differently, but I think that... I'm going to have to cut some of this. But I think...
No.
But I think if you see her in relation to the other women, right, then she's the most motherly.
Mm.
Right? Because I think the plot line, especially in relation between, say, Seven of Nine and Janeway, that Janeway is the mother figure.
Yeah.
In this, a lot more than the others.
I'm not sure I see her as a mother figure in that way. It's interesting to me that people do, though. But... what stands out to me about Janeway is the transition from the captain, where you have that distance from your crew. It's the sort of business-type professional relationship, very hierarchical in that nature of you have your captain's mess. You don't go eat with your crew normally. But in sort of emergency situations and tough times, that's when you have to have your face visible, your presence known, and you have to connect with those... crew members on a very human level.
I think on a kind of different level, I think Star Trek has always had... I mean, the captain is pride of place for the show, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, different shows have gone to different series or versions of Star Trek have gone to different lengths to emphasize how much it's an ensemble cast, right? So there's other kind of characters who are more or less main characters, right? But there's always been this kind of, well, the captain is all things to all people kind of thing, right? I mean, and it has, in that sense, kind of admiring view of that kind of military command structure, right? I mean, you know, because of the way this episodes are set up and are themed and the storylines and stuff, you're quite often allowed to forget briefly that, well, hang on a second, this is a military ship, right? And it has a command structure and all the rest of it. And then at the end of the episode, of course, it always comes back, captain's log, right? All of a sudden, we're back to that kind of, well, this is the captain's voice speaking.
Well, in theory, none of them are warships. I say in theory, right? Because the distinction's never made objectively clear, except in one episode of Enterprise.
or Defiant with Deep Space Nine.
It's not the primary setting, though.
But I mean, in later seasons, it really does get involved in the war.
Okay, but war-capable ships.
That's...
I mean, you know, you can talk about dual-use weaponry or whatever but I mean, it's a ship that can blow stuff
up. The immediate response would be to look at... So, Gene Roddenberry is inspired partly by the stories of Horatio Hornblower. There's no such thing as a non-war-capable Navy ship. They all have some munitions on board.
Yeah, no, fair enough. But I think they still stick to a military command structure and everything
else. That's true.
I mean, the Federation is a military body.
The Federation is deeply authoritarian as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I mean, it has this prime directive, and then after that point, it's like, do what we say.
Yeah, I mean, I always find Star Trek a little bit uncomfortable because it does that kind of... Well, you have to accept as fiat that the Federation has solved all problems on Earth, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, everything outside of the Federation's borders or whatever is the exception, right? So that requires pragmatism. That requires the captain to make difficult choices about the future of his ship and his crew, right? And that kind of thing. I mean, it's the same setup we see again and again. And I think actually it's Star Trek at its most... troporific, right? It's most reliant on tropes when it's dealing with those questions. And also, it's the major failing of the recent film. I think every opportunity that the recent film had to deal with some of those interesting issues, and thematically it was trying to point towards them. Oh, beyond, you know, the frontier and all this kind of stuff, the frontier pushes back. And then the explosions got in the way and we couldn't talk about that anymore.
That being said, though, the more recent Enterprise series does address those issues,
yes,
because you don't have a Federation. It's created through the process of that show. And there is a switch between the different seasons where you have discussions over militarization, having military-trained fighting personnel on the ship.
Yeah. There is that moment where they return to, I think it's Jupiter, and they get loaded up with more guns and the Mako unit. And they have a conversation. This fundamentally changes what it is we're doing out here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm not saying it never discusses it. I mean, I haven't seen all the episodes, and you know, but I think there's still this underlying current. I mean, actually, in Enterprise, you know, if we're going to talk about the defining things of a particular TV series, it's the intro credits, right?
Yeah.
And Enterprise has the entire Enlightenment, right? Hollis flight. It's got the Vitruvian Man, Leonardo da Vinci's like flying machines. And all the rest of it.
But no Yuri Gagarin.
Yuri Gagarin. And then you see the Enterprise or whatever the ship was called. I presume it was
the thing in First Contact.
Yeah. Fly out, taking racism to the stars, you know. you know, with this kind of triumphalist music, right? I mean, it was almost exactly the same as, I don't know whether you guys played this, but exactly the same as the introductory cinematic to Civilization IV.
Yeah.
Right, you have the inspirational music and Enlightenment and all the rest of it.
It's also, so there's that bit in that introduction where they have, because they show us one of the HMS Enterprises, and they show us Enterprise the Space Shuttle, which weirdly was named after the Enterprise in the original series, and then on to Star Trek's Enterprise. And the thing is, okay, I get this whole Voyager Discovery thing, but the Royal Navy was not just in the world of Discovery. The Royal Navy went around killing people and stealing things. So I wonder, by building that world of, hey, we're progressing along this human arc, choose to ignore the parts of history that actually involved the nasty non-Federation stuff?
Actually, it's what you mentioned about the flying scenes that brings that up. It's, for some reason, it just sort of clicked the parallel with, I can't remember which Leni Riefenstahl film, but the one where you have the really long opening scene of the sort of flying through the clouds, it's one of the sort of propaganda films. But it just makes me think of that, and there's an interesting parallel. It'd be interesting to see, actually, those two clips together.
It's not Triumph of the Will, is it?
Yes,
Triumph of the Will.
Yeah, I think there's two threads to pay attention to here, and I think, actually, this is my big analysis of the core tenets of Star Trek.
Lay it down, Alex.
Lay it down. So the first thing is the kind of things that it may very well be, and I don't know much about, and Gene Roddenberry was in it for, right, which is this kind of humanitarian enlightenment thing, right? And along with that, you do get some of the tensions between the crew and all the rest of it. You know, you've got the psychic doctor in Next Generation who plays the conscience, right? in a lot of these situations. And then the other aspect of that, right, and I'm going to say that actually this is what a lot of the fan scene was built around, is the machines, the technology, and everything else, right? I mean, and like, I think that, at least to my knowledge, Star Trek's one of those early things, early examples of a fictional thing where people then felt the need to go back and retroactively systematize absolutely everything.
There's an extent to which that's true, but it's always been very tongue-in-cheek. If you ever play the Star Trek RPG, there's a table at the back of the book for you to roll random technobabble. So
no, absolutely, yeah.
Nobody attempts to take the idea of what does this part of the technology seriously. It's indulged in, but you roll three dice and say, oh, I know what the problem with the ship is. We need to decouple the magnetized ion field.
Right, I mean, but I think there's probably various takes on it, but I think it is a real trend, right? I mean, you have developments, you know, this basically Haynes manuals for Star Trek ships, and a lot of the early board games you have, like Starfleet Battles and things like that, have these obscenely complex, like, machine systems that the entire games are built around. So you do have this kind of Heinlein-esque kind of admiration for
techno fetishism.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and I think that develops. That's also a line that goes straight through. I mean, the original reboot film, right? The first Abrams one
with all the lens flare.
I mean, the absolute paradigm shot of that film is when he's riding along on a motorbike and there's a spaceship, right? Because the spaceship is just a bigger motorbike. With guns.
It actually makes me think of Galaxy Quest, because I think that movie expresses it really well. I mean, the entire plot of that movie centers around these geeks being able to find a manual and tell them how to
get through that room with the metal hammers that has no other purpose. I love the fact that probably the fourth best Star Trek film is Galaxy Quest.
I kind of disagree with you on that, but let's just agree that the first best is the one where Spock is in San Francisco and shuts down the guy at the boombox.
Khan. The best one's Khan.
Yeah.
No, what's the best Star Trek film? Voyage Home.
With the whales and San Francisco.
Voyage Home is I guess, I don't know, fifth best?
No, it's definitely, of the movies, I think the funnest of them for...
I think this can definitely take up the rest of the episode.
Okay, so for the quick record, the best five Star Trek films are Wrath of Khan, First Contact, Star Trek Beyond, I actually really liked, Galaxy Quest, and then Voyage Home, in fifth.
I got a genuine question, right, just to bring things back a little bit. I can see no real reason why they would call it Star Trek Beyond.
Because the last one was also a pun on walking somewhere. You trek into darkness, you trek beyond somewhere.
Okay.
I think it's just meant to be a pun.
Is it? I thought it was just another allusion to the frontier.
But they don't really go beyond anywhere, because, spoilers for Star Trek film listeners.
The nebula.
They do, but it's somewhere a Starfleet ship has already been. Spoilers.
I don't, but...
Maybe it's a joke.
I mean, on the topic of the new film, right, I mean... I think the three of us here that have seen it, right? I mean, I walked out of that thinking that it fulfilled what I wanted it to be, which was a solid Star Trek episode.
Yeah.
But I think actually any of the thematic interest, like the kind of interesting themes that, to be honest, we need if we're going to fill a podcast episode, were largely sidelined.
I think it certainly looks strong when you compare it to the other two members of the reboot, because as other people have commented, Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness were films that featured characters with the same names, but had no interest in exploring any ideas of Star Trek. Whereas, especially Star Trek Into Darkness, with the whole stupid mystery box where, no, we've cast Benedict Cumberbatch, but it's definitely not playing Khan. And then, oh, what's the big twist? He's playing Khan, and it just didn't work. Whereas at least in Star Trek Beyond, there are questions of what is the Federation for, why would someone want to live on a starship, and how they interact with non-Federation species in a way that isn't just Captain Kirk having sex with green aliens.
Well, I think they kind of did that at the beginning and the end for 5 minutes, and largely... I'm not sure, I mean...
Well, the nice way of saying this, then, would be that that's just a premise.
Yeah, possibly. Right, I mean,
because the whole thing happened because a captain went out of line. Was he captain at that point? I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but I think the captain going out of line thing, at least for these like recent films, is just a kind of trope to make the film slightly more edgy than it actually is. I mean, I'm not entirely sure the film worked as a plot, actually, because the whole, oh, by the way, this guy is Idris Elba, like, and he's going to run away. I mean, that was just dropped in the last 20 minutes of the film.
Captain's going out of line is how they generate basic drama. So you'd be surprised how many of the episodes of original series in Next Generation are Kirk or Picard going, woe is us, I want to break the Prime Directive.
Yeah, I mean, but I think it would be the actual interesting question in that situation is, does everyone else in the Federation do that? And what happens, you know, what happens if they do?
From what we've seen of it, I'd say yes. I mean, certainly Janeway does that.
I think it's kind of a bigger... It's almost one of the big talking points about Janeway, right? Because she's set up as this person who's really willing or very keen on following the rules because she's... Exactly, because that's what she's holding on to. But then she's pushed beyond that.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually quite a big thing for Janeway.
Well, there's an episode... I forget entirely what the plot of the Voyager episode is, but there's an episode where, within the same 45 minutes, Voyager comes across the thing they need, and Janeway's just like, blast our way and take it. And then later in that same episode, a bunch of aliens need something off Voyager, and she's like, no, how dare you?
Yeah, I mean... But I think it's probably always going to be true that when you posit that kind of thing, right, when you say, well, oh, by the way, here's this society that has solved all problems, right, you're always going to run into the problem of writing interesting stories, right? I mean, and admittedly, you know, Ian Banks does exactly the same thing. Most of his culture novels are set on the edges of the culture, yeah, precisely because they make it interesting. But I'm not sure how much of the program really works in that sense. I mean, I don't think... I mean, most of the Star Trek that I've seen, right, and it's probably quite a lot of episodes spread over years in a disjointed fashion, but there's very little about the Federation that isn't people on the ship talking about the Federation. Do you know what I mean? There's relatively few, you know, what I'm trying to say is it's not like something like Babylon 5, which is like a explicit explanation of what society is like in all these different places. Instead, it's... Well, we have these rules, and sometimes we don't follow them because, and you know, let's do an exposition dump. So I'm not sure how well Star Trek as a whole reflects on the themes that it kind of sets out to.
Although, speaking of experiences of living in the Federation, I think Deep Space Nine has multiple interesting takes on it, because you have the sort of part where Sisko goes back to Earth for a while.
Yeah.
And that gives, I think, a better perspective of what sort of contemporary Earth is like. But also, the space station itself is an interesting environment because you have issues of power changing hands, who's in charge, partnerships, alliances, but also contentious nature of occupiers and occupied.
And it's built into the very physical structure of the station. And that's something they play with, at least very well on the pilot. They don't really play with it as much later on. But they talk about how the captain's office is stationed above everyone else. And there's that scene in the pilot where Kira's trying to intimidate the Cardassians. And she has to run up the staircase to stand in front of the viewing screen from an elevated position.
I was going to follow that up by saying Deep Space Nine is the one that comes closest.
Yeah.
but I think... Having watched these things in a slightly wonky order, I think, and I've said this on the podcast before, that the reason I like Deep Space Nine is because it came closest to being Babylon 5.
I can see that as a Babylon 5 fan, definitely. It's interesting, too, because it's not just written into the architecture, but also even in how the place is decorated. You like the odd pillow shapes that you have in the rooms.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's different. You feel it's different from a Federation spaceship.
Yeah, and again, to draw the comparison, I mean, Babylon 5 had this with literally different atmospheres in different parts of the station. So, you know, whenever someone wanted to go talk to Ambassador Kosh or whatever, they had to run around and find breathing apparatus first.
And also the sort of lower decks where you have more people crowded into them, and there's... Yeah. Whereas you have upper decks that are nicer, larger rooms, wider hallways even. It's the privilege of having this sort of open space.
Yeah, for a non-hierarchical society, the Federation has one hell of a hierarchy in many of its facilities.
It basically lives under martial law, doesn't it?
Effectively. I mean, the thing is, this is because we don't see boring episodes where nothing happens. But
we don't see any characters that, apart from family members occasionally, that... You know, I mean, maybe there are, I mean, there are some stories about people sending money home and all that kind of stuff, right?
I guess the character who explores this is the Doctor, right?
Yeah.
Because he's the only crew member we see come up against Federation law.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not a person, and this is a problem.
Yeah.
And so the Federation has racial and gender and species equality, but it still has problems with personhood.
And somewhat with Seven of Nine as well.
That's true.
And the whole deciding what to do with her because she was Borg, is she Borg, all of the questions of is she a potential threat or risk.
Yeah, and then there's this episode where who's it? Tuvok and Neelix become one thing.
Yeah, I mean,
and then they have to decide whether they're meant to stay this one thing, which is not categorized because it's not a species.
I mean, I think, I guess the episodes that come closest to... Because, I mean, we said earlier that it doesn't have a hugely active AI, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, there are a few episodes which try to touch on that, right? And, I mean, Q effectively fills that function, even though he might be extra-dimensional intelligence or whatever. I mean, I'm not sure. But it's interesting. I mean, it does age them in that sense, right? Because, I mean, if anything, AI is now the kind of science fiction question du jour, right? I mean, it's things that people are actively addressing in computer science, in philosophy, and all the rest of it. But maybe it just wasn't as much of a problem.
It's also, in general, Star Trek has the Seinfeld problem. We can say that, oh, Babylon 5 did this better, or the culture's more interesting. So if we hadn't had Star Trek, we wouldn't have either of those things.
No, absolutely.
It's also important to not forget about Bashir as well. In terms of, I mean, we talk about AIs and other species, but there's also the issue of human genetic modification and how Bashir, by his very nature, is in essence illegal to Federation rules and laws, and how his parents end up making the deal to sort of suffer the consequences for that so he can go on living his life.
Yeah, I wonder whether these kind of things are also addressed in the context of holograms. There must have been. I can't think of an example, but... So, again, Voyager, I think there's this episode where they're all stuck in a holodeck, not realizing that they're...
It's probably quite a lot of episodes.
Yeah.
Well, with Voyager, there's a species that can communicate only through the holodeck that they come across. But there's also the sort of revolt of the holograms that the Doctor...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, and this is purely from memory / imagination, but... Is it the case that a lot of these kind of questions about the kind of personal questions of the characters are answered better through the holodeck episodes than they are through the actual...
I think there's a... So that's certainly true of, say, characters who are seen to be apart. I mean, it's certainly true of Riker and Picard and, to an extent, Janeway. But I'm not sure that's true of, say, Tom Paris and B'Elanna Torres.
I mean, there is, of course, the classic trope of where someone's on the holodeck and someone interrupts them.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's your kind of in to the character's deepest and darkest, right? Like, that no one knows that Captain Picard really likes sitting in Cuba drinking whatever. You know,
so he plays that all the time in his cabin, so...
Yeah.
Well, the holodeck is beneficial also because it is very much a writer's sandbox. They can create or explore aspects of the characters at will. I mean, with B'Elanna Torres, you have the exploration of her Klingon identity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That comes up in the series. But also with Janeway, you have the, the Irish town and the...
And the frilly dress.
The romance, though. and the falling for a holodeck character because she's limited in who she could possibly be with.
I think my concern with that, though, is that actually if some of the most interesting questions about identity and all the rest of it have to be dealt with on the holodeck, quite often through transporting people to Earth, right, and Earth-like settings and Earth-like relationships, then actually that's a sign that the space setting we're dealing with, the real life in the series, is actually not all that well fleshed out.
Yeah, but I think another way to approach it is, what if the holodeck is like the sci-fi for people in the sci-fi? Right, so we're using sci-fi partially because we like to imagine other worlds.
That's true.
That's literally what people can do on the holodeck.
Yeah, no, so. I think you're right. I'm being overly harsh for the sake of being provocative, but it turns out it doesn't work.
So, I mean, it's arguably not a coincidence that our conversation has focused on the original series TNG, DS9 and Voyager, and not Enterprise or the animated series or all those films that nobody really likes. Why is it that those four, Kirk, Picard, Janeway and Sisko, why are they more central to the fandom, do we think, than...
It's a shame, because I think Enterprise as a series really got a lot of flack that it shouldn't have. I went through and rewatched it and realized that actually there's a lot of interesting stuff in this series that they don't well explore in the other series.
I always say that Enterprise, if you want to find the worst episode of Star Trek, it's probably an Enterprise episode. If you want to find the best episode of Star Trek, it's probably an Enterprise episode.
Yeah. And they actually, and it's interesting because it goes back to the holodeck point. They start out without a holodeck.
Yeah.
Or shields, or photons.
They have replicators, but they don't really, some crew don't use them. They have a cook. It's very, shall I say, space rustic for the Federation.
And of course they have Phlox, who's great.
Phlox is amazing.
I mean, is he there arguably to let them do rustic medicine, right? To give their, because while he's really advanced educationally, he uses leeches and rodents and stuff.
Or is he there to explore concepts with polyamory?
That's true.
He's there, I think, possibly for multiple reasons, and I would throw in comedic relief, too.
Yeah.
Because he's just a character that you like to see on screen. His stories are interesting and engaging, and it's, at that point, entertainment.
But how much do we actually know about, say, Phlox's species?
Well, he's the only Denobulan we really see.
Except for his wife.
That's true.
One of his wives.
And we know that he has, because he's part of the interspecies medical exchange, which sounds like a really dangerous thing to base your interspecies exchange on. I mean, I don't know why it's like sports probably isn't fair, whatever sport you end up being good at. I don't know, maybe do art and culture rather than, you know, medicine, where a single molecule could kill the wrong alien. But we see Denobula from the point of view of his pen pal, I think, one episode. But generally, in the same way that Spock had to represent Vulcans to begin with, Phlox has to be all Denobulans.
Aren't there a few episodes where the episode is narrated from a different voice?
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite an interesting... I mean, coming back to the command structure thing, I mean, that is the point at which Star Trek actually might say some interesting things about that kind of social aspect, right?
I mean, certainly one of the best episodes of Enterprise is the one where Phlox has to render every other member of the crew unconscious. And then sail the ship through a nebula that's giving everyone radiation.
Right.
Voyager does an episode like that as well, doesn't it? Yeah. The Doctor ends up in command. Why is it always the Doctor?
That's an interesting question, actually. Because they tend to feature the Doctor more prominently as each of the series goes on.
Well, I mean, the original series didn't... McCoy was one of the big three. And then from then on, there's always been a Doctor, but they've been they've not been one of the principal leads.
The Doctor always seems to be apart from the rest of the crew, just physically,
yeah,
right? Because
the thing,
they're stuck in sickbay. And then they always... So say the Doctor in Voyager is hologram, right? And then... You have the female Doctor, and then you have the alien Doctor on an exchange. So they always seem to be quite separate. So I think there's a particular tension in putting that person in charge, because, I don't know, you probably take them to be the least qualified, I guess? I don't know.
The what's odd with Enterprise is their moment of, oh no, we put the unqualified person in charge, is when they make Hoshi deck officer, because all the other senior officers are off doing something. Because they break the rule of never put all the senior officers on one shuttlecraft. Except DS9. DS9, someone always makes a point of yelling as they leave the room who's in charge of the station. Even if it's Quark.
I mean, it's an interesting cutaway, right? Like, scene-wise.
Yeah.
Oh, look, we spent 5 minutes on the bridge now. Like, cut away.
Although, we can't just mention the Doctors and then talk about bridge and command structure without mentioning the command hologram.
Yes.
I mean, the fact that they have that exploration of the Doctor's character by creating sort of a separate but also the same character that can take command if need be, but also it plays into the sort of compartmentalization that you have where, oh, great, it's going to be another Doctor episode, for example.
But I think that's interesting because that's something that certainly comes up in a couple of things. Like, so it came up already when we were talking about this whole thing being military and being explorers and all these things. So they happen to be several things at the same time. It's something that, again, you have in the background of Janeway, who starts off as a scientist and then becomes a leader person? I don't know what the term... Command track, right? So they're all having to do several things at the same time, and I wonder whether that's another exploration of that.
She's also... And I've not seen every episode of the original series or TNG. Certainly in my recollection, Janeway is posited as the scientist one rather than the starship one. And yet she feels like the captain most readily willing to use violence. I mean, maybe that's because we're meant to think she's in a more dangerous part of the galaxy. But...
Yeah, so what would you... If you had to give the other captains taglines, what would that be?
Kirk is the one who sleeps with alien women.
In a pyjama, yes.
In his weird green V-neck shirt, which yeah. Archer wears at one point for no readily apparent reason. I don't know. Scott Bakula was ruined for me by a friend who said that basically you can imagine Enterprise as an episode of Quantum Leap. And that Scott Bakula has just jumped into Archer's body and doesn't quite know what he's doing. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Archer gets this episode where he's like, no, violence. Picard, every time his ship gets shot, is like, ah, let's have a peace conference. It's like, they just shot your ship, Jean-Luc. Yeah. Shoot back.
Is he the peacemaker or the philosopher, though?
He's just the decisive one, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean... That's
the non-threatening dad.
I mean, you know, make it so is the classic thing, right? I mean, you know, and you have an entire, built into that one phrase, you have an entire idea, right? I mean, he's decisive, he's delegating all at once, and all he has to say is do it, right? You know, so I mean, I don't know, I think he's probably the most thoroughly characterized for me, but...
Yeah.
And also in a way that is kind of... I don't know, maybe Sisko is as well. I mean, Sisko's more actively characterised. I think it might just be Patrick Stewart. I mean, it's just...
Picard gets... Well, Patrick Stewart's really good, but Picard gets multiple films to explore who he is.
And the Borg storyline, which is really interesting, actually.
So, First Contact is partly about him, and Generations is partly about him. Yeah. And what's the one with Tom Hardy as Captain Picard? Is it Insurrection or Nemesis? There's one where it turns out there's an alien clone of Picard played by Tom Hardy and...
General question, since I think we were starting off by talking about the films in the other series. How important are the films to Star Trek for you? Because personally, I don't think they're
don't
that important.
Fairly universally slam them? I mean... I mean, I know, like, you know, there's people that say Wrath of Khan, you know, there's people that have one or two that they really like.
So the joke is that the odd-numbered ones are bad and the even-numbered ones are good.
But I'm going to say that I don't think there's anyone that's into it because of the films. And I think that maybe that's what they're trying to do with the reboot. They're trying to restart this franchise.
I guess that's true, because you can't get someone into Star Trek by showing them Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, I think the reason people like or dislike the films is because they... fit in or don't fit in with their idea of Star Trek that they've gone from somewhere else.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with ratings for the new series as well. Isn't it going to broadcast the first episode, I think, on television networks, but after that it's going online primarily.
Oh, really?
So it'll be interesting to see what the viewership numbers are going to be.
When is that?
We should check that.
Is it a new crew? Well...
Yeah, and I think it's also going to feature more of the non-captain-centric type of storylines. It's supposedly centered on someone in engineering.
So we
should confirm that before...
I did promise we'd talk about every series, so I should check. Am I the only one who's watched the cartoon one?
Probably.
Yeah.
Talk about it. We demand that you fill the rest of the time.
There's literally like one thing to say about the animated series apart from the cat and the weird... there's two things. One is that being a cartoon, they could do more interesting aliens in that day, right?
Right.
Yeah. Because it's the joke of Star Trek that every alien has different ears or a different forehead.
Yeah.
Whereas in the animated series, at least, there's the cat woman and there's the guy with three legs and three arms. But...
Of course, there's incorporeal.
Yeah.
There's plenty of those.
What's that Futurama joke? Oh, we always like those episodes with the energy beings.
Yeah.
But the anime, each episode of the animated series is like 25 minutes long.
Right.
And that seems to be about the right length for some of them, because it's almost as if we have this idea, let's explore this idea for a short while, okay, episode over.
When was this made?
After the original series. I think it might have been the decade after, because it stars all of the original cast apart from the guy who plays Chekhov.
Because there is a really interesting, I mean, there's a long-running thing of, like, quite famous science fiction franchises being made into animations, right?
Yeah.
I mean, MechWarrior was, or BattleTech. Starship Troopers was. Now Star Trek, apparently. I can't say I've ever... Well, actually, I vaguely remember it being a thing.
But... Most of it wasn't very good. I just... As a possibility.
You watched it all before this episode.
I've watched a few episodes. It always seems like each episode contains, hey, here's this thing. It's like, well, you could never expand, you could never fill an episode, let alone a film with that. But yeah, okay, sure. So what would it be like if all the members of the Enterprise's crew shrank and they had to try and operate the starship being much smaller?
I mean, it sounds like a fairly standard cartoon setup, right? You carry on.
Now I'm waiting for the seagulls.
There's no aliens that look like seagulls and stuff.
Wasn't there a shrunken version of Deep Space Nine? Or no, the Defiant or one of the shuttles got shrunk.
Oh, yeah, that.
Yeah, I think the Doctor shrunk at some point. But I think that was more like a joke than an episode.
Holiday. Like the Magic School Bus. But...
Yeah. Okay.
It was. The Magic School Bus shuttle episode.
I mean, the Magic School... I mean, you could probably draw thematic lines between the Magic School Bus and Star Trek, right?
Mostly the automatic doors. And the teacher looked a bit like Janeway.
Miss Frizzle?
I think we're way off topic
here. Yeah. So the reboot films, to sort of come full circle and talk about the newest film... The reboot films have always all had a 3D version, as most Hollywood blockbusters do, usually try and get a release in China. And certainly the first Star Trek The Motion Picture, as it was called, had this really weird computer animated bit. And it was a bunch of red lines on the screen, or maybe they were green. And it looks awful today, but at the time, that was a selling point. Like, ooh, look at this computer graphics in it.
It's like a targeting computer from Star Wars. That kind of thing.
So, I mean, does the... modern technology add anything to what we're getting out of Star Trek? Or is the old models on a string thing still just as good? I mean, did you get anything out of the 3D in the most recent one?
I think it had a lot of potential, but I'm not sure whether it worked. As in, I think that 3D is a good idea for anything in space. Right? But I'm not sure if it was used like that.
I'm going to say that there's a few films that do use 3D well. When it comes to space, right?
Yeah.
And gravity is the main one. Okay.
Which is interestingly hard science fiction rather than...
But I think I'm going to be interested to see over the long term whether the impact of 3D is mostly to shock people that haven't seen many 3D films.
Hmm.
Right? Because I think apart from my eyes having real trouble with the depth of field shift, which is forced on you in these films, I think that... One of the good things about 3D, which is, oh, look, isn't space really, really big and empty, isn't something that this film does.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, most of the film is not about, not even set in kind of deeper space anyway. So it becomes a little bit of a, well, look what our 3D artist did, right? I mean, there's some cool stuff. Actually, the station is really cool.
And the bit with and you've got the center with the gravity.
And you've got variable gravity and all the rest of it, which... was a bit wasted as a plot point later on, but visually it's quite cool. You've got these kind of Escher-like setups where different parts of the station have different facings. That said, I don't think it offered anything, really. I mean, of course, the other thing you have is the kind of Inception-style fight scenes where things are tumbling over and people are flying everywhere and in different directions and all the rest of it.
That was cool. I did like this.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that... That's anything that it offers apart from the fact that it's new.
The thing that did work in terms of... Because immersing your audience in the cinema experience is back in fashion. And there used to be smelloscope cinemas where they'd pump a certain scent in or they'd shake the seat. And weirdly, the one bit of immersion that did work is when they... Spoilers. When they're doing the bit where they're playing the Beastie Boys music really loud... evidently on the soundtrack, they cranked up the bass.
Yeah, definitely.
And in the cinema we saw it in, the bass was high enough to shake the seats we were sitting in. And so the idea that this is a sonic weapon which you as an audience member can feel worked really well. There's nothing technologically advanced about it. You just have to think of doing that as a sound editor. And also the whole using pop music and sci-fi that Guardians of the Galaxy did. It's everywhere now.
But it's interesting that, you know, I mean, those kind of things work by being self-referential, because there's part of you that's laughing because it's that song, right? You know, and this is what Guardians of the Galaxy did brilliantly, right? I mean, this is why Quentin Tarantino films, like, and the music are so close together.
So to me, the big difference there is that in Guardians of the Galaxy and Star Trek, the music is diegetic. It is literally being played by the characters incongruously to the setting.
Well, you have the scene with young Kirk in the first
reboot.
It's
the same song, yeah.
And it's playing the song, but you also have that sort of... I think it plays into that emotional attachment that you have with a lot of Americans and driving and the concepts of freedom that you get with that. And it's this kid stealing this car and, you know, getting away from a stepdad and just making a run for it.
And of course it sets up a certain, like, ideological setting for the film, right? So, I mean, it asks you to compare the character that's listening to the music or, you know, to what you associate with that song, right? I mean, in Guardians of the Galaxy, awesome mix number one, right? He's playing it on a tape, right? Which says it, and it's all stuff from the late 60s, 70s, right? You know, so that's setting up the entire tone of the film because we associate those things. So it is diegetic, it is set in the film, but it is a knowing wink, right?
Yeah. But you can't do a Suicide Squad. You can't just slap a given popular rock song over your not otherwise particularly good film and expect the audience to go, hey, I like that song, now I like your film.
Yeah, but I mean, these things blur, right? I mean, you know, I mean, to that, you know, you have the sound in space problem, right? I mean, it's not purely diegetic in the sense that, you know, you can hear it and the camera is outside of the Enterprise, right? So, I mean, it is to an extent, right? I mean, it doesn't go as far as something like The Wire, where all the music, apart from the ending things, is diegetic, and it actually makes really interesting setting. But, I mean, I'm not too sure that... I mean, it says something interesting about what Star Trek thinks about its space setting, right? Whether the space setting is just a backdrop for encounters between different aliens and different people and all the rest of it, or whether it's actually interested in space in the kind of Carl Sagan way, which is kind of, oh, space is really big, isn't that fascinating and beautiful in its own right?
It's certainly interested in Carl Sagan's view that when you fly all the way out there, turn around and look back at Earth, Earth is a tiny blue dot.
Yeah, but it does that through relationship to...
You don't need the alien civilizations to do that. It's a sense of scale. Nationalism collapses as soon as you can travel across the galaxy. Because it becomes meaningless.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure whether it does it in a slightly different language to maybe the way we think about it now. I mean, hyperdrive is a really interesting thing in science fiction, right? Because, I mean, it is a hand-wavy thing.
Yeah.
But it also says something about how close people are to each other.
I love the fact that the Vulcans decide the point at which they're allowed to contact an alien species is when they've discovered warp travel. The moment they reach generic sci-fi hand wave is the point at which we'll contact them.
Yeah, I mean that's a repeated thing through the entirety of science fiction, right? I mean, you know, that runs through Banksy's culture. You know, it runs through, you know, the idea of the Dyson Sphere and the kind of energy levels, you know, oh, can this civilization harness the power of a star yet? You know, and all those ideas. I mean, interestingly, these are all ideas of progress, right?
Yeah.
But I think it will be interesting whether those things change depending on when they were made.
I think that's what I'm saying is that it's interesting that I think it does reflect on those points, Matt. I'm not saying that it doesn't, but I think it probably reflects on them in a slightly different language to how I think about them now.
Yeah, I think so, especially because I think what is interesting with having this film refer back to something that was made quite some time ago, I don't even know when, is in how far these things age well or don't age well and what the political points being made there. So Zulu being a case in point with that, right? As in, like, what does it mean to have this character suddenly turn out to be gay.
As a tribute to the actor.
Yeah, who wasn't entirely comfortable with that, right? Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting thing with aging going on, which I think has also links back to the discussion about technology, right?
There's also this sort of cohort of newer series coming out now. A lot of them out of Canada, so like Dark Matter, Killjoys. There's also The Expanse. And a lot of the themes that are being addressed are in the Star Trek movies but have been addressed in other sci-fi as well are continuing to be addressed. So everything from a blink drive that takes you instantaneously as a prized item to the concept that you might have no Earth at all, mm-hmm. or a war between Mars and Earth for independence, potentially.
That's a weirdly common one. Why are Mars independence movements always... Because there's one in the early days of the Star Trek plot.
Well, because it's the classic colonization story, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I'm sure before that there was a similar trope for the moon. I can't point at any now, but...
There is a particular book series that started in the 60s. I think something like The Moon is a Terrible Mistress or something like that.
Okay.
That I don't know if it started it, but it really highlights that genre of the moon as a penal colony that then fights for independence.
Because, of course, I mean, it's the natural consequence of what you were saying earlier, Matt, in terms of, well... You know, we're leaving out, you know, we're having the great age of exploration without the colonial bit, right?
Yeah.
And it does bring that back in. I think Fab Five had a Mars rebellion, did it?
Yeah. As does Star Trek has one of its early plot, I believe. Total Recall has it. Warhammer 40,000 has it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, coming back to the hyperdrive question, I mean, obviously. I mean, it is quite an apt comparison, actually. I mean, Mars is to Earth in these things what Ireland was to England.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the slightly uncomfortably close neighbour, you know, and this is the interesting thing about hyperdrives, right? I mean, in terms of or warp drives or whatever you want to call them, is just how fast they go. I mean, there's a reason Douglas Adams called it the infinite improbability drive, right? It's because it enables plot through random deus ex machina.
And speaking of those themes, I mean, a lot of them have come up in an earlier podcast with the Ursula Le Guin's type of works.
Yeah.
Because she does that in more of her sci-fi type novels.
Where they both call each other the moon.
Yeah.
There's two identically sized planets and they call each other the moon.
Oh, that is quite cool.
It is really clever.
But I think what...
And Ansibles.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think what is interesting about this is that I wonder... See, initially I was thinking when you were talking that it just seems as if we're switching scale, right? So you had England and Ireland, and now it's the Earth and the Moon. It's
yeah, no,
the same
absolutely.
Problem, right?
Yeah, I think it's the same narrative and historical, but, you know, narrative thing playing itself out in science fiction as we've seen all the way back.
Yeah, but can we think about things that maybe the Moon thing, where we can use things like hyperdrive in order to break that logic?
Well, I mean, there's an interesting series of tropes that we talked about when we talked about Utopia,
mm-hmm.
that the break in the logic is that you can't get there.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, you couldn't navigate your way to Utopia. I'm trying to think of something, but the only thing I can think of is The Land of the Giants and the BFG, because I saw that the other day.
That's why they put blank pages at the end of Atlases. This is my favourite line from the book.
The film Big Fish, right? Yeah. Where, you know, the joke is throughout the entire film that actually the stories that the dad was telling the entire time were true, even though they were just fairy tales. Right, but you can't go there. You know, this is why isolated settings work so well, right?
Well, there's a few. I mean, Cowboy Bebop does that by breaking it.
Yeah.
Cowboy Bebop has the hyperspace gates, and then, oops, we blew up the moon.
Yeah, there's a few that do that, like consciously cut off contact with some alien race because. I mean, the Accession does it in one of the Banks novels. It's been there for the entire book. And then you realise that just this big black sphere floating in space just disappears. And it's like, well, that's just it.
Yeah, I wonder how this relates to... We were talking earlier about the kind of dynamics of how those people move, right? So Voyage is about coming back, whereas Enterprise is about going out. And these kind of things. I wonder how that relates. That seems to be kind of... trying to get beyond it, but still stuck with it.
Well, I mean, they do draw on... I mean, that's a classic mythic thing, right? You know, the you know, Odysseus or Paradise Lost and all the rest of it, you know, you go down into hell and then you come back out, you know, and then you end up in heaven. And, you know, I mean, I was thinking about this actually when I was recently, when I was playing a game called Dark Souls, where I realized that for the entire, like, first third or something of the game, you are going down.
Yeah.
Right. And then all of a sudden, like, the break of this when you get to the bottom is that you're massively and extremely quickly elevated back up into this kind of heavenly scene. And it's completely disorienting. And because your mind is automatically associating itself with these directions, with narrative tropes, right? You know, Odysseus leaves, Odysseus returns, right? And, you know, the war against Troy and the Iliad. You know, these are, we're quite used to seeing these as quite distinct and separable narrative ideas. You go out to war, and then the second part of the story is when you come back.
But what makes Voyager different is that while many of these stories have returning home, to make the odd comparison, Voyager and the Odyssey, Odyssey simply means voyage.
Yeah.
They're about how difficult it is to get home.
No, absolutely. I mean, and you know, there's a further take on that, which is how impossible it is once you've arrived, because you're not the same person or whatever else. You
know? Yeah, which is, and then the thing with Voyager is interesting, that it doesn't get there through space, I suppose, but through time.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So it ends in time travel rather than space travel.
Also, the journey itself and adapting to a starship as home, especially the episodes where they come into contact with the generational ships as well.
Mm-hmm.
And exploring the idea that shifting from a planet-based home to the idea that the starship itself is where you're from.
Yeah. There was an interesting game came out a while back. I honestly can't remember the name, and I'm going to have to put the link up or something, where the concept was you were traveling away from home on a starship and the entire game was you communicating with home. But as you got further away, your messages would take longer to get there. And so it would get to the point where it's taking 20 years for a message to arrive home because communications can only travel at light speed. And it was a kind of based around this whole generation starship idea, right? The idea that there is an entire generation of people on a ship. And Kim Stanley Robinson's written a book about this recently that sounds quite interesting.
I mean, Voyager and Enterprise play with that. Voyager has to, you know, struggle to get any communications back to work. And then Enterprise has this wonderful thing where they've got these tiny satellites to keep having to throw out every so often. And it's like, oh, communications aren't working properly. Some random alien has crashed into one of our probes.
I was not having a point. I was just throwing in Tali from Mass Effect.
Because Mass Effect, that's the other
like the archetype, right? That you have a whole civilization on a ship.
Yeah.
That actually poses quite a few problems.
Yeah, and there's actually a show recently that deals with that a bit. The idea that there's this generational spaceship that launched in the 1950s secretly from the US. Spoiler alert, it's actually all just a science experiment. And they have the fake space, and the people on the ship don't actually know it, but it's the exploration of the idea that these people are explorers on the ship, and it deals with the middle generation that's not going to see where they're supposed to arrive
at.
Isn't it an actual experiment of some people simulating living on Mars?
That's just ended, yeah. Apparently successfully, no one died. So.
Woo!
There you go.
That should just about do us. We're off to all spend our replicator credits. Thanks for listening.
All right.